You want to lead?
Sashi
Puki Chukshing Maitok Trum Rira Bling Shin Yen De Gen Padi Sangye Shingdu Mikte Uwagi Jokun Amdak Shingla Chupa Shuk Hiram Guru Rana Mandala Kam Nirya Tsayami Chudang Soki Choknam La Jangchu Bardu Dakni Kapsuchi Daki Chinyen Gipe Sunangi Jola Penshir Sangye Drupashu Chudang Soki Choknam La Jangchu Vardu Dakni Kyapsuchi Daki Chinyen Gipe Sunamki Jola Penchir Sangye Drupashu
Sangye
Churang Soki Choknamla Jangchu Vardu Dakni Kyapsuchi Daki chenyen gipe sunam ki Chola penshir sangye jupashu. Coming into your meditation posture. And just taking a few moments to withdraw your awareness from the past, from the future, even from what's happening in the present around you. Just that sense of letting go. With the knowledge that we have a choice of where to place our mind. And place your awareness the crown of the head. And just slowly, slowly traveling down the physical form, letting go of tension as you go. Spending extra time wherever you need to. Your hand was gripping before, it's as though you're opening up the hand, opening the whole palm up, letting go. It's that sort of feeling throughout the whole physical body. Once you've scanned all the way down, scan back up. If your mind isn't already, feel it getting clear and sharp and focused. The energy brightening, expanding. And then come to the feeling of breath moving in your body. It can be the whole physical form as it moves with the breath, or the belly, the chest, tip of the nose. Pick the place where your mind feels most stable and clear. And let go of the focus on the breath. Expand to the whole body. And the room around you. Feeling the different sensations on different parts of your torso, your arms, legs, face. And when you're ready, starting to move. Yeah, making a dedication. So, guess what we're going to do?
Review.
Yes.
What?
Review.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So, what is the main text that we're studying?
Highway for Bodhisattvas.
Right, and who is it by?
Kinsokapa.
Mm-hmm. And what are his dates?
1357 to 1419.
Yep. And does anyone know the Tibetan?
Janchu Shunlong.
Yes. And then what is the other text that we're studying as well? The English, what's it called? You know?
I don't remember.
String of sparkling jewels?
Shining jewels. Yep, string of shining jewels. And do you remember who it's by? It's Geshe Sewang Samdrup. And his Tibetan name, his name in Tibetan, or not his name, the text name in Tibetan.
Norbai Yutrang?
Yep. Norbai Yutrang. Which it just sounds like such weird Tibetan words to me. It's like nothing else sounds like that, it seems like. Okay. So it is, this is Becoming a Spiritual Warrior, and it's Wednesday, February 14th, Valentine's Day. So, we're going to go over what happens if you break a root vow. So, we went over part of this, but if you break a root vow, number one, you can't see emptiness in this lifetime under the influence of bodhicitta. And so, what does that mean? That's the ticket out of samsara. That's the ticket to Buddhahood, is the start of it, you know, like the first step towards the exit is seeing emptiness directly under the influence of bodhicitta. And so you won't be able to do that in this life. So basically you won't be able to reach Buddhahood in this life if you break a root vow. And on top of the vows being very specific and not as general as they seem, which is why we need to review them a lot or often, you also have to have four attitudes to completely break them, and we'll go over those too. That's number one. Number two, it makes it very difficult to meet spiritual teachers in the future, which would be a great sadness. we kind of have them, you know, these great karmic seeds to have teachers like flowing like water, really, through our center. And, you know, we're able to get to class. We have the teachings, the courses available. So if we break a root vow, that would get a lot more difficult. And then third, you can't increase the virtue needed to see emptiness anymore. You can't do that. So if you have the virtue that it takes to push you into seeing emptiness directly in this lifetime, if you have that, it's like it gets frozen. And if you have any more that you need to collect, you can't collect it in this life. To me, it almost seems like breaking one of the root vows is like earth-shattering or something like that. Like it creates this huge rift or like this huge, because it says it's frozen, you know, like this huge freeze that kind of like shocks the seeds or does something like that. Or just like, my sense in my mind is like it creates like this huge chasm, or, you know, when there's like an earthquake and then there's a huge crevice and you're separated maybe from like all of your friends and family or something like that, but you're separated from all of your karmic seeds that could help you to see emptiness directly in this life under the influence of bodhicitta. And then you can increase that virtue. It's difficult to meet spiritual teachers, like all of this is saying. But that's sort of how I visualize it, or how it seems to me in my mind, like how that could work. Because the workings of karma are deeply hidden. There's different levels of reality, and karma is on the deeply hidden level, and only a Buddha can see the inner workings of karma. So we can, you know, we can understand the basic rules of it, the basic rules of karma, and work with it in a certain way, but we don't really know how it works ultimately until we reach Buddhahood, until we're out of the cycle of suffering. But that's the sense I get. It's like, we just did something so opposite from what we need to be doing to get to Buddhahood that it's like the shockwave. And so the result of that, of breaking a root vow, this is what happens. And it doesn't say that you never can. It says in this life. So it's not that it's hopeless. But also, you're not likely to break these vows. Geshe-la Michael says you're not likely to if you're any kind of morally ethical person. So that's a good thing. So say country.
Country.
Country. Country. Yep. So country is a mental affliction, a completely entwining bad thought, a chain, or a bond. So in order to break a root vow, we have to have these four attitudes in mind. Except for number 9 and number 18. Do you guys remember what those are?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Reaching enlightenment for all beings.
Yep.
Well, then 9 would be the one that is close to the 18 one. I don't remember.
Number 9 is the wrong worldview.
Okay.
Yeah. And believing that.
We were discussing that, right?
That there's no such thing as cause and effect. There's no such thing as past and future lives, that sort of thing. So you have to have these four attitudes. Except for those two, you immediately break them when you do those. So that's what this is saying. So in order to break a root vow, except for number 9 and 18, these are the four attitudes that you have to have in your mind as you do this, the deed. So number 1, not to consider what you're doing or going to do as something wrong. So you think, you know, that's okay, I wasn't in the mood to give what he was asking for. You know, the failing to give material assistance to someone who needs it. And remember, you're their only hope. Like, you're their last hope. They have no other options. You have what you need, and you don't give it to them. And you think, you don't consider that bad. You think, it's okay, I just wasn't in the mood to give what he was asking for. So it's a pretty serious thing to do. It's not just like someone's asking you, hey, do you have, like, I don't know, do you have extra money so I can go get coffee or something like that. Like, if someone is asking you that, it's not like that. It's like someone's asking you, I desperately need something, money for rent, or I'm going to be evicted. I'm going to lose my job because I'm not going to have a place to live and a place to shower and get ready for work. I'm going to maybe lose my car because I won't be able to make car payments. You know, something really extreme, and you're my only hope. There's nobody else that can help me. I have no other friends who can help, no family. I have no other options. And then you just say, no, I don't want to help you. It's that sort of thing. And then you think that that's not bad. So you don't consider it as something wrong that you did. That's number one. You'd be willing to do it again. If they asked me that same thing again, I'd say the same thing. I'd say no. You have, like, no thought that, oh, maybe that was not a good thing to do. There's no thought like that. So if you have one moment of regret ever, you don't break the vow. And for the first one, if you think it's wrong to do the deed at any time during or before you do it, even for a moment, you don't break the vow. Even if you still do the deed, you don't break the vow. So number 2, very similar as number 1. If you have one moment of regret ever, you don't break the vow. So regret depends on thinking it was wrong. God, I wish I hadn't done that. I just, you know, I know it's not right, and I did it anyways. So they give an example, I believe it's in the text, of a person overcome by desire who's going to break their sexual misconduct vow. And they're overcome and they know it's wrong and they're not enjoying it, but they can't help themselves, so they don't break the vow. So many of the secondary vows, if you're struggling against it, you don't break it, even if it overwhelms you, and you do it anyways. Number 3 is you enjoy doing it. You know, the person asks you for what they need, you say no. And then you think, yeah, I'd be willing to do that again. And I enjoyed saying no. I enjoyed telling them I'm not going to help them. So the chances of us having all of these are not that likely, I don't think. I think it's very slim. So for number 3, you enjoy doing it. If you regret doing it, then you don't break the vow. Number 4, you have no shame about doing the deed for reasons relating to yourself or others, which means your own conscience, seeing yourself, like, not liking seeing yourself as that type of person who doesn't help people, or I feel really bad about that, I wish I hadn't done that. And then according, in relation to others, what are all the, you know, like, what does everyone who saw that happen think about me? They, you know, now they know that I'm a big, fat, selfish pig. As Lama Ruth says.
I I had a situation which I didn't know how to handle,
mm-hmm.
and I still don't know how to handle. So I have a good friend who asked me for money, and
mm-hmm.
I gave him the money the first time, expecting that he wouldn't ask me again. But like 2 days later, he asked me for more money, and then like 4 days later, he asked me for more money, and then I was given that money to him. And the last time he asked me for more money, and I said no, just because I felt that I was that he was taking advantage of me,
mm-hmm.
and that's why I didn't do it. And I was thinking about the karmic result of that,
mm-hmm.
and I just didn't know how to tell them that, you know, well, how much money are you going to ask me for, and if I actually can do it, can actually lend the money to you.
Yeah.
Because I'm a person who's, I'm not very organized sometimes, especially with money. I just kind of see how much, I budget, but I don't detail budget, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I don't know if I'm going to be able to, I know in, like, in general, but I don't know in detail if I'm going to
yeah.
make it this month, you know, some saying it that way, like,
yeah.
I need to pay all this, and then I have all this to save, and then to give away, or whatever.
Yeah.
So I was just, because I was in the way of thinking that I should just, if he asked me out, I'm just going to give it away. Right? But he was increasing, and it was being, like, in shorter periods of time. So I was in that situation, and I didn't know how to handle it. I had to say no, and I felt bad, but I didn't give that to him. Like, I didn't give the money away. So
yeah,
I don't know if I take my vows, if I'm gonna be breaking, because some situations are like harder to think about. I don't know. Maybe it was just
well, it kind of sounds like you had some, like you weren't sure if it was right or wrong to do it.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So you're not, I don't think that you would have been breaking it if you had it. Because the first one is not to consider what you're doing as something wrong. So even if you have like some moment of, even if you have some moment of thinking, like, I don't know if this is right or wrong, even if you're not sure at any moment, then you wouldn't be breaking it. And it doesn't sound like, I don't know, did you enjoy doing it? Did you enjoy saying no?
No, I felt bad, but at the same time, my basic feeling was that I was being taken advantage of. That was my, like, why, I mean, you should be able to, I mean, I did lend you money, but I cannot lend you, you know, more than you are asking me for. And I felt, I was angry, actually, a little bit angry, because he was asking me for more money. Without
yeah.
even considering, you know, our friendship, or, you know, how much I could, you know, lend to him or something like that. But it is something I did in the past, for sure. So I just didn't know how to, if I was going to say no, I was going to start having like economic money problems in my life as well. You know, I
not necessarily. Why? Did he tell you why?
No, and I didn't ask.
And
I
does he have...
Right now it's not a good time to, you know.
Yeah.
I just didn't say anything. I just didn't want to get... Because I was getting angry at the... You know, you go through all this, when you're angry, you go through all this thinking, and I was thinking, I don't know, maybe he thought I was a millionaire or something like that. Why are you, I mean, we know each other, why are you doing this? I was like, you know, I'm practicing too a bit. I'm trying not to say no. No, I don't like to say no, but at this point I need to say no, because I don't know my finances. I have the money, but I don't know if that money I'm going to be using it for something else. So I was
right.
feeling nervous about it. I was feeling uncomfortable.
And you need to be able to take care of your family.
Yes.
Too. Does he have other people who can help him?
Yeah, I believe so.
So part of that vow is that they have nobody else to help them. You are their last resort. Because that's what you're thinking of, the failing to give material assistance when someone asks.
Yes.
Yeah, so part of that vow is they have absolutely no one else that they can go to.
Okay.
And you have the money and you're able to give it, and you just decide not to.
Yes.
And it's out of, oh gosh, can I remember now? It's out of greed or, because I think there was two different ones in regards to this one.
But I think the fact that I was...
But one was out of greed.
Angry,
yeah.
About him asking me for more money when I already gave him more, you know, like 2 days after and like that. He probably was needing a money for sure, but I mean, to do it. But at the same time, I didn't know how to handle it.
Yeah.
I said no for, just in case I need this money for my family, I'm just not gonna do it. I don't have any money, I said. I did have the money, but I wasn't gonna give it.
Yeah. I don't think that really comes, I don't think that comes close, because you're thinking of what you need for your family. Maybe... I always find it helpful to communicate more with the person, because most of the time I'm misunderstanding people, or like I have an idea in my head that's completely wrong or completely opposite. So sometimes maybe, you know, in the future when you talk to him, you can say something like, I was feeling worried that I wasn't going to have, money to cover what I needed for my family, and there was frustration that was starting to come up. Would you be willing to explain to me the reason behind why you would need to borrow this money, and maybe we can come up with a solution or something like that, you know, like in some way communicating and at least keeping lines of communication open. It doesn't mean you're going to give them the money, but it might help to shift things a little bit, and then you'll be like, oh, I understand now. And then maybe you can think of a solution that would help him that he wouldn't think of. Because that's what, you know, that's what other people can do for us. We get stuck in our one way of thinking, and then someone else can see it a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So that might help with the, in the future if anything comes up. I always find talking about it's like a lot more helpful. Because when I'm starting to feel frustrated or angry, when you take it to the level of like, I'm feeling like this now because I need to be able to take care of finances for my family, for myself. I'm worried I'm not going to be able to, and maybe like I'm worried about your situation. Can you explain to me what's going on, and maybe we can come up with another solution.
That sounds like a good idea. I just didn't feel like asking.
Yeah.
I was expecting more of him, like, in the sense of just, you know, understand that I already, you know, lend you money, and you're asking me for more. So
yeah, it's an awkward situation.
Yeah.
And I think we don't always know how to handle things like that,
but
especially
think,
when we're surprised.
Asking him about, you know, tell him also that I'm good, because I was worried, like, why you need so much money and so fast, and why do you think I have the money or what support you?
Do he do drugs or gamble or?
No. I think he's going through a bad situation. He lost his job, and he has a family, and he has a mortgage, and he has.
Oh.
But, I mean.
Yeah.
I have to support my family, but to help him out like the way he wanted to, it's just too much for me.
Yeah, and that's reasonable. It doesn't mean that generosity or keeping that vow doesn't mean that you're expected to, like, give away everything that you own. That's not what it's talking about. Maybe at, like, we would never do something like that unless we're at a point, like, a really high point in our spiritual practice where, like, we knew that's what we had to do or something like that. Like, we knew it was important to do that. But, I mean, I know for me, that's not going to be for a really long time, most likely. So it's not that you're expected to do that. I don't think you have to feel bad for doing what you think is right in this situation. If you look back at it and you feel like you didn't handle it the way you wanted to, or you wish you'd done something different, then do, we'll talk about it later tonight, but do the four powers and then see yourself doing, handling it differently, like do a meditation where you see yourself handling the situation differently, the way you'd like to have done it if it's different. Mm-hmm. Or you can, you know, in exploring what is it that bothers you about it.
Also, I guess when anger hits you, I think you gotta take some time off. Like, you gotta separate
a
bit until you will calm down and you can, when you're, like, cold, come back and just see the situation from another side.
Because
I see that when I get angry, in my case, it just grows at the
moment.
Yep. I just hear something and I just think it's negative right away. Like something that,
totally.
And I get more. And so it's just better if I. So that's what I did. I just kind of like.
And that's a good thing.
But I'm still thinking about it and.
Yep. Do you have something to say, Jenny?
No, I was thinking of a similar situation where someone had borrowed money with the promise to pay it back, and it's been over 4 years now, and there's times when I still think about it and just start churning over the fact that, you know, at the time we said that, you know, we were supposed to be paid back, like, within 4 months because he was going to be getting some money. And it was, like, just to hold him over until he got. And then when he got that money, we never got paid back.
Yeah,
and
I want to get
ended up going into something else. And so I think about it, sometimes it's like, okay, I need, you know, just let it go, you know, because consider that was a gift. And then every once in a while, it's like I grab onto that attachment of, but he was supposed to pay it back. You know, we could use that money right now. So.
Did you talk to him about it? Again? Or no?
I haven't. It was more between my husband and he had the arrangement. And so there's this part of me that's like, well, it was between them. It's not necessarily like my responsibility even to follow up on it. But at the same time, I think about that it's, I'm the one that's having the issue with it. So.
Because there's a story, and I can't remember who it is, but. It's like some high lama, his house gets burglarized, and the police come, and they say, this man stole all these things from your house. Do you want to prosecute? Or, you know, they ask him these questions, and the high lama, he says, he didn't steal anything. I gave it all to him. And so that's what it makes me think of. Like, I don't know if the way the sequence of events have played out, but if there's some way where you can feel like preemptively, like on your own, you're deciding this is a gift. I'm giving this to you. Not like, okay, now that you didn't pay me back, I'm just going to forget about it. But like, I don't know if there's some way to navigate it where you can feel like, from your own side, without anything to do with him, I've decided this is a gift. Doesn't matter what he ever does or doesn't do. Even if he wants to pay it back now, I'm not taking it. Something like that. It might be helpful because, especially with things that keep coming up like that, it's good to like put a stop to him if you can.
And
I so it might work like that.
Really, I haven't really integrated it because it's like I thought about that, but then later on, the feeling comes back up. So it's like,
yeah.
Obviously I haven't really resolved.
So maybe if you could, like, if you wanted to work with it, you could do meditation where you invite him to come sit with you and you talk to him and you say, you know, this happened and we lent you money and you didn't pay it back, but I want you to know it's okay because I'm giving it to you. And you can even think, like, you can rewrite it, you know, in the past, like, and decide that from the start this was a gift. Or you could, like, write a letter to him or something, never give it to him, but something along those lines if it's something that bothers you and you wanted to work with it. But it made me think of that story.
Mm-hmm. In my case, it's I don't even expect that he's going to pay me back, but I just don't want to be him just, you know, asking me for more money. I think that's what and my anger comes from.
And I think part of it...
It's like fear that how long is this going to go on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if I will be able to... I know if that's going to create bad karma. Those are my fears. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I think part of it for me, too, it's one of our godchildren. So it was part of like the lesson of teaching him financial responsibility. And so I think I also have emotions coming up of, well, I obviously... We didn't do a very good job of teaching him... But then I'm thinking, well, but not necessarily. You know, just because he didn't pay it back doesn't mean that he hasn't learned how to be responsible. Because he's helping other people. And so I'm trying to look at it that way. Is that we provided him the opportunity to then help others. So. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It is tricky. So he's young?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, it's tricky because especially when... like a younger kid, it's not good to teach them that they can just not do things and not say anything about it.
And we were going to help his sister with something, but then he didn't pay us back, then we didn't have the money to help her. And so it was just, I mean, there's a lot of emotions around things, and I think that's kind of why it's heavy. Because there's a lot of, you know, entwined emotions.
Yep.
So, yeah, meditating on it.
Yeah,
the four powers. The four powers. How do they work? We can see that maybe some other time.
We'll get to it tonight.
Okay.
It's a full S slide, so we'll get to the four powers.
I've done it, but I just
It's okay. We'll go over them again.
All right.
So you break the root vow, except for 9 and 18, by having these four attitudes in your mind. Okay? So...
Do you need to have all of them? Or just one of them?
We're going to go into that right now, actually. So let me see if I forgot anything else that's going on here. Okay. So, all four factors must be complete to break a root vow. All four of them. So, if you have a moment of regret or conscience, of not enjoying the deed, of thinking it's wrong, if any of those happen for a moment at any time, you don't break the vow. So, you'd have to not think it was wrong, be willing to do it again, enjoy doing it, and you don't have any shame or consideration. So if you commit one of the 16 root downfalls without all four of these, it becomes a secondary downfall. So it's not as serious. Okay. And now... So there's a story about Master Aryadeva, who's on the left. And a demon came up and asked for his eyeball. And he pulled his eyeball out of his head and gave it to the demon. And the demon threw it on the floor and smashed it. So he stomped his eyeball. And at that point, Master Ayadeva said, "This is impossible. Human beings are impossible. I completely give up." So at that moment, he broke his root vows, his root bodhisattva vows. Basically, he gave back his vows because he's saying that the complete opposite of what the bodhisattva vows are. He's saying, forget it, I'm not doing this. Human beings are impossible.
What happened to him?
If I'm thinking of the right story, he continued to study, and I believe he would tell monks in the monastery, "I've seen more with my one eyeball than you'll ever see with two," or something like that. Mm-hmm. So he kept studying. And then the same thing happened to Master Nagarjuna, and that's how he died. That's Master Nagarjuna on the right. So I asked Ami about the breaking the wish for enlightenment vow, which is what this is talking about. And she said, in order to break the wish for enlightenment, we have to think and or believe that we're turning away from bodhicitta with the four conditions that we just talked about. Breaking the vow doesn't include just struggling in general with keeping up our wish to attain bodhicitta or become a bodhisattva. Rather, it's actively giving up the wish in general and not momentarily being exhausted or something like that. Or specifically turning away from one particular person and giving up on them. So, for example, excluding someone who you're frustrated with, fed up with, angry with, whom we see as destructive, even like politicians. And actively stop including them in our intention, our dedication prayers, our four immeasurable practices, etc. So you may say verbally that you're giving up in general, or that you're giving up on a particular person, or you may just feel or think it deeply in your heart. So you can have, it can be any of those ways. Because we were talking about if it had to just be verbal last week. So no, it can be verbal or mental, or just mentally thinking it. So if you break a root vow, it destroys your vows, but you can take them again if you have some small feeling of wanting to help all others. And this is called a big impurity. In the Bodhisattva code language, this means that all four were there. All four of those conditions that we talked about. That big impurity wipes out the vows. So you just have to have that basic inkling of wanting to help others. And if that inkling of wanting to help all others isn't there, then you can't retake the bodhisattva vows. Even if you retake the vows, you can't reach the first bhumi in this life. And then there's a medium breaking of a root vow, which is not to think it's wrong, and then to have one or two of the other factors. So you don't think it's wrong, and then you have one or two of two, three, and four. So your vow is damaged by the medium breaking. So in that case, to restore the vows, you have to collect three people together and confess the deed to them. So that's when you have one, not considering it's wrong, and one or two of the others. But not all four, because that'd be full breaking. Then there's a small breaking of a root vow. You wouldn't have number one, thinking it was wrong. But you'd have any of the other factors, one, two, or all three of them. So in the small breaking, you just confess to one person. And then after that, you'll have the vows just as purely as you did to begin with, but not if you completely break them.
The confession exists in mm-hmm. language. I can go with you and talk.
Mm-hmm. It could be anybody. Anybody in the Sangha? It could be...
But it has to be somebody from the Sangha.
I don't... I'm trying to remember. Because they do... It's called Sojung in the monastery, where they do... They go and confess the things they've done. Let's see. Would it make sense that it would have to be someone from the Sangha?
I think so, because you also need some guidance, right? At the same time.
Maybe. It would. I think it would probably be best, but I think it would... No, I don't really know for sure. I think it would be more powerful for sure if it's someone who understands what you're talking about. Like, yeah. Why it would have been a problem to not... to have done whatever it is you're confessing. Because I think that's part of the power of doing it.
And what's the name in...
Sojung. It's like a...
And it's
big, like...
Mm-hmm.
gathering of the monks. I think sometimes it's a very small group, too. From what I remember. Would it need to be someone from the Sangha? I don't think it would have to be. That's just my thinking. It could be someone who understands, though.
I can't remember what the note said. I remember reading, but I can't.
If I'm going to do it, if I'm going to do it, I think I would rather use the Sangha, right?
Yeah, me too. I know it feels more powerful if I talk to someone in the Sangha about it. Or like my parents who understand, as opposed to someone who doesn't, because then they might like argue with you about, well, no, it's not a bad thing, don't worry about it, or because maybe it's a little more obscure vow that's not obviously right or wrong, you know, until you know the background of it. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to take a break, and then we'll go into purification. How to purify.
Can I offer you
Okay. All right, so we're moving on to karmic purification. All right, so it is possible all the bad karma that we have, we can purify. And sometimes instead of taking a rebirth in a lower realm, then maybe we get a headache, something like that. So the first step... We must have these four when we confess to breaking the vows. So the first one is the basis force, or taking refuge. This one is basically you recommit yourself to becoming enlightened, to seeing emptiness directly, and to those who have seen emptiness. The real three jewels, that's what those are. So you put your trust in that and you think, that's what I'm after. I want to be one of those beings who have achieved enlightenment, seen emptiness directly, and reached Buddhahood, you know, which is achieving enlightenment. But that's what I want to do. So you'd say, I'm a Buddhist and I want to achieve the Bodhisattva ideal. And you think about... Going for refuge, I usually think, I'm trying to reach enlightenment. That's my purpose. Like remembering your intention, remembering your purpose and your practice. That's my goal. I want to reach enlightenment. Remembering that is the first step. And then the second is, well, Do you remember we talked about Master Sangha, how he would purify? So he would carry around a stupa with him, and every time he had a bad thought, he would be riding along with his followers going, who knows, a teaching. And he would stop immediately, get down off his horse, put the stupa down, and confess right there. Every time he had a bad thought. Every single time. So people hated traveling with him. And he would do the four forces. He would do the four powers. Because he didn't want to die with that negativity on his mind, on his conscience. And that's also the whole idea of the vow book. Do you guys know the vow book?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know? Yeah.
The purple one? You mean the book, the actual
one? Nope. Oh. The, like, keeping the vow book?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
I think that's six times.
Six times a day book? Yeah. So you'll put, because after you have your bodhisattva vows, you'll have a few different sets of vows to go through. And I would just go how I organize them, because you'll get vow cards when you take your vows too, is, how did it work out? I think I do vow number 1, 22, 44, 88, 108, and then I guess it was 118, but that seems kind of high. So that's how I organize them. And then the second day I do 2, 23, 45, like just the next one from each of those. So I would be cycling through all of them. And if you go in order, they tend to be kind of similar, so it's a little redundant. But if you split them up that way, then you can cycle through and you're getting like different types of vows each day too, each time. So you split up the page into six sections, and then you write the vow at the top of each little section. And you put plus, minus, and to do. So plus is, how did I keep this vow? What did I do to support this vow? Even if it's like way out concentric circle. And the negative is, what's the closest I came to breaking this? You put that in there. If I can't think of something close to that vow, I'll just put a different negative in there too. And then the to do. Yeah.
With that.
Yep. And then the to-do is the makeup activity. And so doing that is like going through these purifications six times a day. Because you're purifying something six times a day. And I think it's better if you can't think of anything with that vow, just think of something else. Because there's so many negativities that we're doing all the time. Might as well take that opportunity to purify something. So that's how you can check in and keep up with your vows, too, and keep them fresh, and so you can remember them so you don't break them without just because you're not remembering. So they call this the basis force, because when you fall down, you need some hard ground to get up from. So this is like your support. And then there's the destruction force. So I think of these, I think of number 1, I just think of it as refuge. Number 2, I think of regret. So you'll hear them called different things. Regret, it's the intelligent regret of an educated Buddhist. Which is basically, I just planted this crappy seed. I really wish I hadn't done that. I know it's going to happen. It felt crappy doing it. It's going to come up in the future as something else crappy. It probably wasn't fun for whoever I did this action towards. So it's just this like, dang, I wish I hadn't done that. It's not, I'm a terrible person. I did this awful thing. I'm so horrible. It's like, shoot, I just did that thing again and I really regret it. Just like a matter-of-fact thing. So it's a very cold understanding of how karma is collected, knowing that you'll suffer from that bad deed. So the basic requirement for karma to be collected is just that you're there. You're seeing it happen. When you harm someone, and as that karma flowers, you'll have a similar perception of someone harming you, and it's all wrapped up in emptiness, too. The minute you do a bad deed, and at a certain point as you're doing the bad deed, the more educated you get as a Buddhist, the moment you realize what you did, you know where it's going to stay, how it's going to stay, and how it's going to ripen, and you think, oh my gosh, am I crazy? What did I just do? And confession is like the process of wearing down the bottom of a shoe. You have to do it over and over and over again. The only time I've felt like something gets cleansed right away is if you catch it right away. Like we were talking about with, what was it, Master Sangha? Master Sangha, who would get down off of his horse and purify, every time something negative came up. So if you do it right away, I get the sense that it's been totally destroyed right away. But then the longer you wait, it's growing and growing and growing. And
otherwise it has a chance to start.
And then it just, like, it takes hold. Almost like it has roots or something that are harder to pull out. You know, like if the seeds just dropped on the top of the soil and nothing's happened yet, it's easy to get rid of it. If it's growing all these roots now, then it's hard to pull it up. It takes a lot more effort.
I was thinking, like in our front yard, we have a big oak tree. And so sometimes it's like when all of the acorns fall, if we scoop them all up, that's really easy. But you miss one or a squirrel plants it, and then all of a sudden, by the time we've noticed this thing, then you have to get the tool out and make sure you dig down and get everything out of the ground.
Right, and you're not sure if you've gotten all of it.
Exactly.
Yeah, so you have to keep going back again and again. And yeah, exactly, and it's the same with the karmic seeds. So the next step is restraint force, where you stop doing it. So you say, I am not going to do that again for a reasonable amount of time. And sometimes, if it's something really hard, while you're purifying it, you'll have done it again already in your mind. Like the thought will pop up again. So you have to be really diligent when you're purifying and try to keep your mind there and say, I'm not going to do this for 1 second if you can. If that's like the most you can do. If you can do longer. If it's something big and you know you can say, I will never do that again, then say, I'll never do it again.
So this is something we can do with ourselves whenever we are. And then puja is, to remember the seeds.
The fire puja?
That's another way of purifying.
Okay. Yeah, and you can do that on your own whenever you want to as well. Yeah.
I thought you need, okay. Mm-mm. Because of having the formality of it at retreat, I thought that you needed to have someone.
Nope, you can do it whenever, on your own. Yep.
I missed a very good retreat, right?
Yes, it was. It was very good.
My experience was very, very good.
And when you first start working with them, they feel kind of clunky. But as you get more and more used to them, then you can do it really quickly and have it sink in, too. Like, have it feel like it's working and do it quickly after a while. At first, it's a little bit like, takes a little bit longer and you have to get used to it. So, number one, taking refuge. Two, regret. 3, restraint. You stop doing it. And I remember His Holiness saying that there's some sort of power in saying, I will never do this again. And I experience that as true, but you have to kind of feel into it yourself. Even if you do it again and you said, I will never do this again, is it what does it feel like in that moment for you? Does it feel like that's the way to go and that's going to be the most powerful? And that's what he said. Sometimes it's a lot more powerful to do that, even if you know you're going to break it again. So that one can be a little tricky. The advice that Geshe Michael gives in this class is reasonable amount of time. And I think, from what I remember, it might be better to start out with the reasonable amount of time. And then as you get more fluid with it and you get really used to it, then you can play around with like the never again. But I remember finding it very helpful to just say the amount of time that I knew I could restrain myself.
And I think it might depend on what it is. I mean, there's some things that I know I can say, I am never doing that again.
Yeah.
And other things that I don't ever want to do it again, but I'm human and I have a feeling that it's going
to
happen.
Right, right. And to His Holiness's point, what he was saying is even with those things where you think this is probably going to happen again, sometimes it's more powerful just saying, I will never do that again. So it's a practice. And you just have to go with what feels right in that situation.
So is there any more, I guess I'm just thinking, is there any more karmic consequence if you say, I'm never doing it again, and then you break it, versus saying, okay, I'm not going to do it again for 3 hours, and you may make it through 3 hours, and then you break it? I'm just wondering.
I think it depends on your intention. Because I've heard both teachings, and I've done both. And so for, like, with lying and being like really accurate with speech, for the most part, I'm like really accurate with my speech. But sometimes I think there's more power in like saying, you know, someone asked me to do something, I'll say, well, I'll try. Like sometimes there's more power in just saying, yes, I'll do that. Even if maybe I forget or something happens. So sometimes it depends. It just depends, I think. It's a hard one. Because if I'm working on, depends, I think, what you're working on in your practice, too. If I'm trying to be really mindful of my speech and not doing anything that's even remotely a lie, like no matter how far out it is from the lie center, then being really accurate would probably be a good thing. But then if I'm maybe like lacking power in some way, then I think the other way would be better. Because there's a certain point too where we're like too picky about it. You know, like with lying, I would never say yes completely to anything. And that's kind of a disservice to someone else. Like, I'll plan on remembering to do that. But it's kind of like wishy-washy in a way. Although my intention was, I don't want to say I'm going to do this and then I don't do it.
You're being non-committal, so, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm planning to do it, but I don't know if I'm going to remember. So sometimes I think it's a better thing to say, sure, I'll do that. And maybe by saying that, it helps me to do it. I think it's really complicated, all of the nuances of
the
morality.
And what came up for me, too, is my thought of, you know, how hard I am on myself when I don't follow through on something that I've committed to. I don't allow myself to be human and forget or make a mistake. And
yeah.
Sometimes I guess I was thinking that there might be, you know, a greater karmic consequence if I say, oh, yes, I'm going to do that, and then I don't because, but I guess what I'm realizing is that it's just more me beating myself up and being hard on myself. Having high expectations.
So yeah. Yeah, I think it's a tricky one.
Yeah.
at least it has been for me in my experience, so that's why I think it's tricky when someone else is probably like, no, it's really cut and dry. But I don't know. I'd say it would depend what you're working on in your practice. If you're trying to practice, you know, more kindness towards yourself, or if you see in the situation for this person that I'm talking to, it's going to be more helpful if I say yes. And I mean, with the knowledge, it's possible I might forget. But it's possible anybody forgets too, you know, but to just commit to something, I think sometimes is a lot more powerful. Not like when, you know, I'm not doing this at all, but I'm going to say yes. Of course not like that. Or like, I don't think I'm going to do this, but I'm going to say yes. Or there's like a slim chance. Not like that, but I have the full intention to do it, so I'm going to say I'm going to do it. And then if I don't, then, you know, it's like, okay, what happened here? I wish I'd been able to, but something came up and prevented me from doing it. I think that one, it's a hard one. Because the truthfulness, ultimately, what comes from that is that everything we say comes true. And also, I think that's the driving force behind practice, being able to meditate every day, being able to keep your book every day, come to class when you want to, study, that sort of thing. I think that's the driving force behind it, is keeping your word, or doing the things that you say you're going to do. But not being too rigid with it. So I think I've been pretty rigid with it, and it's more useful probably to soften up a little. And then I see people who seem to be completely not rigid with it at all, and they can't do the things that they want to do. Like, they just say, yeah, I'm going to do that, and no one believes them, and they don't do it. So there's like those two ends of the spectrum. That's why we have to get enlightened, because enlightened beings, like the Buddha, knows what to give up and what to take up. So he always knows exactly what to do. Which is the most annoying thing about being, you know, not the most, but pretty big, not knowing what to do all the time. Even like, and we have a lot of help with all the teachings. A lot of people don't even have that. So you're just like, what the heck do I do? And if you
wanting to do something.
Yeah.
And then, yeah.
Like, do I go on this trip, or do I go to this class? Do I do something with my family? Do I study? Or, you know, not even that big of a difference, but just what to do in everyday situations. There's so many.
Or even in trying to help somebody.
Uh-huh.
Like, is giving them this going to help them, or is giving them that going to keep them from finding their own resourcefulness?
Yeah. Because we're pretty much totally blind. We don't have omniscience. And that's what we will have.
And we got ourselves in this position, right?
Uh-huh.
Just by desiring stuff, like by
wishing. Yeah. Yeah, just getting like more and more sucked into that cycle of ignorance, of thinking that I can like micromanage everything to get it exactly perfectly how I want it to look, and then somehow that's going to bring my happiness.
But our true self is being enlightened, right?
That's our ultimate.
That's our goal, but before, you know, before staying in this samsara place, were we enlightened?
Well,
this is an odd question, but.
There is that teaching that, like, I think it's different lineages who teach that Buddha nature means that there's, like, our true nature is enlightened self is already enlightened in a sense.
Uh-huh.
But maybe. I don't know what exact
the
lineage.
Okay. I think.
I don't know.
And I've heard people say that too, Geshe Michael, and I believe mostly our whole lineage says that no, Buddha nature does not mean that you're already a Buddha and it's just covered up.
Uh-huh.
Buddha nature, it means emptiness, that you have the potential to be a Buddha, and the emptiness, your emptiness, is going to be the same as when you're a Buddha. Like, you're going to still have that emptiness. That's what it is. That's Buddha nature. So it's a little different. But it can be a really helpful idea.
It's not like, I remember him talking about the onion, you know, the layers. And,
yeah.
You know, there's that inside, that where everything comes from. Well,
yeah.
I think about that.
And there is... Well, for me, I think it depends how you experience it, because for me, the idea that I was originally enlightened and then I screwed everything up is really annoying for me. It's like, it feels really blaming to me.
It does?
Yeah.
That's how it feels for me. But for other people, or maybe it sounds like for you, it might be really helpful. So then it would be a good teaching for you to practice with.
For me, it's more like, I'm sorry, for me it's more like a process that you have to go through anyways.
Yeah.
So to me it almost sounds more like, well, from Christian or Catholicism, the fallen angel kind of thing. It's like I was there and then I fell.
Yeah.
And I thought about that. So, and since we talk about in our lineage, you know, since beginningless time, it's like there was no beginning. So, in a sense, we've always been in samsara until we reach enlightenment. So it wasn't like there was anything before. And I know that's kind of a hard concept to I mean, even sometimes for me.
Yeah.
Even thinking about infinity. But it's essentially that we've that's always true. Been in this cycle.
It makes sense because everything that is basically born or starving, it ends, right? Because everything else has just been there forever, or it's just there.
Well, karmically, I mean, if we're thinking of time in a linear sense, which I don't think it is ultimately. Like, ultimately there's not time. It's just something we've kind of made up, but it doesn't make sense that we were enlightened and then we weren't. Because most all the teachings that I've heard is that it's not that enlightenment's permanent, but it's not, but you're not going to come back to samsara after that either. So I don't karmically and from the teachings, because nothing's permanent, everything's changing.
Not even enlightenment.
Right. Because permanent means unchanging.
Okay.
The way we think of permanent is like it's changing, but it stays the same, which is inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
Permanent in Buddhism means unchanging. So of course, when you're a Buddha, you're changing because you're moving, you're doing things. But those karmic seeds, you're constantly helping people. You're just replanting and replanting and replanting. You've cleared out all your negative seeds. So you're not going back to samsara. You're staying as an enlightened being. So from that sense, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make any sense to me that you would go back to samsara. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, our true, like our destiny, you could think of it, or like our true nature would be Buddhahood, and you can think of it as like uncovering it, or you're evolving towards it. But from how Lama Marut teaches it, he says ultimately it doesn't matter. Either you're like shedding until you're a Buddha, or you're like evolving until you're Buddha. And either way, you're a Buddha both ways. So I think it's whatever's helpful to think about it as. Because I don't know that one's necessarily right and one's wrong.
So what comes after enlightenment? if it's not permanent, like it change, if it changes, does it, anybody know?
Well, and my understanding, okay, and just my understanding of it,
mm-hmm.
is that when you reach the enlightenment, so Buddhas are actually separate from space and time. They can see all space and all time. They're omniscient. And mm-hmm. so like we're stuck in space-time right now, and that's why we're in this realm, in this cycle. But once they separate from it, and I think of it as they go into a different dimension other than these four. And so in that dimension, it's not the same kind. There's not the same laws of physics. It's not. So unchanging doesn't necessarily, I think, have the same meaning, because there's not duality. There's not any of the concepts that we have here. So,
mm-hmm.
so to me, I mean, in a way, you could be enlightened and yet, I mean, and not return, but yet still be able to change.
Yeah, because
you're in a totally different dimension.
I think it's the
sounds amazing.
I just figured there's different rules there that I don't understand and stuff. That's totally
yeah, I think that's probably very true. And it's also that we have the wrong idea of what changing means. We think that changing means it's going to end, that it has to end. But that's because we live in samsara, and that's what it does mean here, is that everything ends. But it's not because it's changing, it's just that that's the nature of the suffering realm that we're living in. So things can keep changing and, in some sense, stay the same. You know, like, you're a Buddha and you're changing and you're still a Buddha. And you're changing and you're still a Buddha. And you're changing and you're a Buddha. But changing doesn't have to be from one thing to something else. But that's how we think of it.
Okay.
So changing can, it just means like, if you were unchanging, you wouldn't be able to move. Because I'm changing just by moving my hands.
Man,
you would be like stuck. That's what it's referring to in one sense. So Buddhas are active, you know, they're doing things. They're teaching, they're sending out emanation bodies to serve all beings. So they're changing all the time in that sense of like moving and they're thinking and, you know, maybe talking and doing all these different things. So there's nothing that's unchanging in Buddhism. Nothing is. So it's just that sense, it's just saying that they're a changing thing, just like everything else is in all of space and time, you know. There's not anything unchanging. So it doesn't, I know with our thinking, it implies to us that it will end. But that's because we are used to samsara, where everything does end. Like our life ends, everything that's good ends, everything that's bad ends. And so we have that sense that it'll be the same when we're a Buddha or something, but it won't be. Because like Jenny's saying, we'll be a different kind of being and we'll see a different reality. It doesn't mean we would have to be anywhere else. Like, you guys sitting right here could be Buddhas, and I don't know that. So you can be enlightened right here and now. It doesn't need to be anywhere else, too.
Yes, for the enlightened ones, we are the doctor in the end.
Yep.
Right now, we're tuning the point.
And they're like, come on!
Drinking water and not knowing it's nectar.
Yeah. Okay. So the restraint force is 3. And then the last one is the antidote force. You do something to make up for what you did. And there was a story about, this is a story that Geshe Michael told, about a man who was in Vietnam, and he wasn't sure if he killed anybody. He would spray fire, you know, like gunfire wildly into the jungle, hoping it hit someone, but he never knew if he really did or not. And he went to Ken Rinpoche, who is Geshe Michael's teacher, and asked, what can I do to make up for this? What would be my antidote? And he said, your father is keeping 2 sheep to kill and eat. I want you to pay for them, pay him for the sheep, and keep them until they die a natural death. And so that was his antidote. And little did he know that sheep live a really long time. And so he kept them for 15 years until they died a natural death. So that's an example of an antidote force. So an antidote force, if you make studying emptiness your antidote force, we do so many bad deeds that we'll be studying emptiness all the time. So you can make that your antidote force too. And it would be like to read a lot about emptiness, to read different explanations of it, compare them and become a connoisseur.
I would like any recommendations?
On reading about emptiness?
Uh-huh.
Well, I always like, of course, The Diamond Cutter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I like reading, like, The Lama Rinchen Mo and Liberation in the Palm of Your Hands. Those are the whole path, and they just have parts on emptiness. But I haven't really read that many texts purely on emptiness. Yeah, I've studied the courses, but not a lot of text just on that.
Well, is there anything else to know, like intellectually speaking, of like what I understand is that basically emptiness is that, you know, everything is empty, and I, with my karma, I see what I see, and this becomes a laptop. And I think I understand it.
So yeah, and usually how it goes, I would suggest what I usually do. I usually listen to teachings. I don't read a lot. I'm on the computer all day long, so when I get home, I don't want to be on the computer and looking at a screen more, so I'll listen to teachings.
Okay.
And you can find a lot of teachings from Lama Marut on emptiness, Geshe Michael, of course. Alan Wallace has a lot of good teachings online. I don't know if he has any on emptiness. Or just looking it up online and finding different teachings. That's what I do.
Okay.
I don't really read that much.
Alan Wallace kind of goes a little bit more into kind of the science side of it as well.
So yeah.
It, depending on,
okay,
you know, if you feel like you're more of a scientific or logic-based, or
no, honestly,
more of a,
I'm not.
Yeah,
I don't understand it that way for some reason.
But it's good to listen to all different explanations of it. Like,
yes,
maybe
yes,
at first,
right,
go towards the one that you resonate with and get that down. And then go and listen to all different ones, because you want to get lots of different perspectives. And as you're listening to those, you'll get a deeper and deeper understanding of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really helpful. You just want to keep listening to it over and over and over. And there might be, look on our website too. There might be teachings from Ami on there.
Well, there should be the recordings from our emptiness class also.
Yeah. Was that last?
Yeah,
that was the last course. So the last course is online too.
That book from Lama Marut, Be a Nobody, I bought it.
Yes.
I haven't read it yet. I bought it. Is that good?
I have that one too, and I read it, but I believe there's parts in there on emptiness too. We can, remind me, we can look through these books and
okay. And
see what's in there too.
Yeah, because I've read, I think, almost all of Geshe Michael's books.
Yeah.
And Lama
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So you could, yeah, in the knowledge base, there's a lot of audio. Yes. Geshe Michael's big into emptiness,
oh, yeah,
too.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I heard
he
a
has
lot
a lot.
Of things. I hear him every now and then just to remind myself.
Mm-hmm. And it's good. And it's good to listen to different teachers, too, and get different takes on it.
Really quick, what's the meaning of, what's your point of view on the meaning of seeing emptiness directly, or the direct perception of emptiness?
Like, what does that mean?
What does that mean? Yeah, exactly.
Well, technically what it means is in meditation, you see directly how reality works. So you're seeing, instead of intellectually, which is how, like, we're talking about it and how we're seeing it all the time until we see it in meditation, we're thinking about it, getting it intellectually, and then in meditation, we're actually seeing how it works. So right before that, and I don't know what that experience is like because I haven't had it, but right before that, we see dependent origination, which is where we see exactly how we're labeling everything. So I'm labeling this as iPhone, this as pointer. We see that directly, and then right after that, we go into deep meditation, and we see the flip side, which is that nothing is self-existent.
Okay.
And in that meditation, we're in a different realm. We're in the, I believe it's the second level of the form realm. And so we're not even, it's said that when you see emptiness directly, you're seeing the emptiness of yourself. But your mind isn't in the same realm, and so you don't have a concept of like, oh, I'm seeing emptiness directly right now.
Oh, okay.
So it's not like that. I don't know.
This is it. Right.
Yeah. And that's how it's always described. It's always described as what it's not, because apparently it's very difficult to describe. So that's the understanding that I have of it.
Yeah. I remember Geshe Michael telling that the image we see is like this big, you know, like very small.
Yeah.
And I always, I don't know why, space.
Yeah.
But I think we're talking about this very interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. So yeah, becoming a connoisseur of emptiness. And it's also for the makeup force, it's also okay to just think about it too. So this step would be the most powerful. If we really understood emptiness, we'd understand the need for morality. So emptiness means that nothing has any nature of its own, and the nature it seems to have comes from the ripening of your past karma. So if you had that deep understanding, you wouldn't ever do anything wrong. It just would not happen. And so I think that also speaks to, if you were a Buddha, you would have no afflictions left. You'd have no negativity, so you would never do anything wrong. There would never be any cause. So you would never be planting any seed that's going to ripen in the future as negative. And then Master Asanga says there's two ways to lose your bodhisattva vows. You can lose your bodhisattva vows by breaking them or by giving them back formally. And breaking number 18 is the same as giving them back formally, which is where you decide, I give up. I'm not going to do this for all living beings. And then holding wrong moral views. And it makes sense, because how could you have the vows after you give up bodhicitta? That's what the vows are. If you say, no, I'm not doing this, forget it, then it just makes sense that you wouldn't have the vows anymore. So, let's see here. Let me look at the homework.
Did I hear homework?
Yes. You know there's homework online, right?
There's what?
There's homework online.
Oh, there is homework online?
Mm-hmm. There's homework and quizzes, and there's a final. So if you do all the homework, quizzes, final for all the courses, then you'll be able to teach the courses at some point if you want to. And also, if you have the time, it's just good to review.
Like I said, I'm taking the vows and I'm moving to the mountain. Outside the society.
Let's see what the meditation is.
Oh, wasn't that Master Asanga who went into the cave for all of those years in order, wasn't it, to be able to, well, to study, but also to avoid breaking the vows?
Oh, I don't know if I've heard that.
Maybe I misunderstood the story, but...
There's probably a paid story, because...
But then it was kind of like, but then he got the realization, you know, he had all of the... Received transmissions and then decided to come back out and teach after. Or maybe it was somebody else who had been.
It might have been. I don't.
Deep meditation for years and somebody said, you know, it's time for you to come out now.
Yeah.
You can't just be in there for.
You need to come and help people.
Yeah. And the teaching should be a higher practice, I suppose. It's like giving a lot, right? Like giving to everybody, like. Teaching is very important.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's also what, it's how you keep the lineage alive.
Okay.
How we'll pass it down to others. So it's been passed down over and over, and that's how we have it. And then we want to pass it on to other people in like a really pure and clean way. And then also, I didn't really think about this before, but when we're a Buddha, all they want to do is listen to teachings and teach. So it seems like it must be planting seeds for that to me, too. Yeah. And I don't think it necessarily has to be formal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
but
let's...
then you have that vow that you teach to somebody who takes it the wrong way, like gets scared and moves away from.
Right, but there were those special requirements in there, so
yep.
That they had to be, is it Mahayana?
Yeah, I believe they have to be Mahayana. They have to be studying it.
Right.
And then you freak them out. There's another one I'm forgetting, though. Your teaching freaks them out, and then they leave Mahayana and they go study Hinayana. I don't know if I'm forgetting one in there. Can't remember if there's three or four. But yeah, so all those things have to be there. And it also says if you really think that they're ready and then it turns out they're not, you don't break the vow. Like, if you really thought they were ready and you checked it out and then they get freaked out and they leave Mahayana, then you don't break it. So they would already have been studying Mahayana. Your teaching freaks them out. They leave Mahayana and they go and study Hinayana. That's to break that vow.
Oh, okay. That's to break that. Yeah, because I was thinking, sometimes people ask me. I try not to say that. I practice Buddhism all the time.
Yeah.
When they ask me and they, oh, you're on, and what is it? And, you know, they try to compare it with other religions.
The other component is that they have wishing bodhicitta.
Oh.
So the qualities of the person that you should not teach, they haven't studied emptiness carefully, your description would scare them, and they have wishing bodhicitta. And as a result, they would give up the Mahayana. And go to the Hinayana.
Okay, so they would already, that would equal that they're already a Mahayana practitioner if they have bodhicitta. What was the first one? They haven't studied emptiness before.
Carefully.
Or carefully. And does it, do we say it has to be all four of them? I think it does.
I didn't write that down.
Yeah, I think it does. I think it needs to be all four. Because it wouldn't make sense if it was just one. Like, they haven't studied emptiness before, and then you break it. That doesn't make sense.
So the pen teaching of emptiness, I find it, like, very exciting, right?
When
somebody asks me, I sometimes, like, try to see if they would grasp it, like, they would understand it. I haven't found anybody who would actually listen to it and say, No, I haven't. But I always kind of like, did you understand? Oh, yeah. Okay, the pen, okay. But, yeah. But I sometimes do that.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if I will break that vow if I, you know, taking this vow. But you already gave me an answer to that. Yes.
And, yeah, I would look at your intention and before you do it, too.
Yeah, that would write, yeah.
Yeah, because it is really fun. And think, like, would this be helpful to them? Could it help them with something? And maybe it does, even if they don't seem impressed.
Maybe they
think about it later.
The thing that would send them to, like, I read the Tibetan Book of Meditation. Mm-hmm. Out of the blue, I just found it in Borders, when Borders was still around. And it blew my mind, the whole book. I was like, wow, this is it. And it seems that only in my family, I'm only the only one that felt that way, but I haven't found any.
Did you, outside. Your family member, your other family members read the book?
My wife tried to read it, but she didn't finish it.
Yeah. It's so interesting that, you know, how everyone has different karmic seeds.
Yeah,
and she's into things you're probably not into.
Exactly. She's very spiritual in other ways.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. Karma is so
she's very spiritual in other ways.
Elusive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she doesn't seem to be attracted to Buddhism.
Yeah.
Some
people just aren't. They're attracted to something different, which is good that there's other paths.
Yeah. But she has more bodhicitta than I do.
Yeah.
She's more compassionate.
Yeah.
In general, with people. Like, the way she's thinking all the time. And then I get that, and she doesn't have that.
Yep.
That's fine.
Yeah, so I think, too, I always find it helpful when Geshe Michael teaches the pen that he then says, like, and the person that you hate at work is the same. That's why it's important. Or, you know, the person you're having difficulty with right now is the same as this pen.
Yeah. I totally understand that.
Yeah, do you say that when you tell people it, too? And they're still
them, yeah. And they seem to not. But you have to hear it, I don't know how many times, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I had kind of an experience of it at the grocery store one day so I was checking out, and the person who was bagging, I explained that I wanted the cartons to go in the smaller bag, because then they wouldn't be flopping over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I was kind of like, you know, this is how I want things to be set up. And they, you know, the person just kind of, it was like, just blow me off and not even do it, or just totally ignore me or whatever. Because it was like, at the moment I finished saying it, the stuff went into the other bag. And I just was seething. Fine, you know, I go home and just deal with it. And then I went back a few days later, and I saw her, and I was talking to her about something else, and she explained to me that English is her, like, third language. She's like, okay, I'm not quite sure what you're asking. And it was like, at that moment, I thought to myself, I thought of that other encounter and was like, she wasn't ignoring me or disrespecting what I'd asked for. She did not even understand what I had asked.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of that same thought of emptiness of, you know, I totally perceived her in one way.
Yeah.
When it was a completely different situation.
Yeah. And it's so funny because no matter how many times that happens to us, we're like shocked every time.
Yes.
We're like, oh my God. There's
horrible.
A different option.
I was thinking about that other interaction and I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe how upset I was with her.
Yeah, totally. I do the same thing.
I asked or said something more instead of just sitting there seething.
Yep. It's that thing where, like, we're misunderstanding things all the time. All the time.
Another thing is, that, for example, Facebook, internet. I break my vows with it. Because I'm so emotional. I read and I just read whatever I want to read, I suppose. And I'm always fighting with everybody. Like, their opinion doesn't matter. My opinion is more important. You know, it's always like that. And I see myself doing it, and then I get upset, and I post something, and I say, no, I'm going to erase it. I'm like that, but I don't. It's the same. I know this is social media, but it's the same when you go into the grocery store. Or to it's the same everywhere. So
yeah.
We get upset for just very small things because we don't understand it.
Yeah, I was thinking about how I handled something like a year ago on Facebook and ended up, my brother ended up unfriending my sister and I over this interaction politics and stuff and our, you know, how we felt people should be treated. But since then it's like I've noticed how I've been pulling away from Facebook the types of things that I interact with are different. The types of things I post are completely different.
I've
noticed that shift this past year.
Yeah, it's good.
I wanted to post it too. Like, I'm just going to go away from social media. But you cannot run away. You have to face it. And you have to
face Facebook.
You have to face it. But you have to overcome it. Like, I don't know. It's also a practice.
And finding balance.
Yeah, but, well, you were talking about, like, you have to have that cooling off period. So maybe, do you implement that with your Facebook usage?
Mm-hmm.
Because then you go back when you're cold.
So when I'm too upset over here, I just go to the other one. And then I come back, hi. No, it's just...
It might be,
strange.
I wonder what would happen if you cut it off for, like, a month. And then went back, what would happen? If it would look different, or if it'd be, like...
I've done that, but in the past I have just closed everything down for a little bit and just...
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to do is not to get away from it, but to not be so reactive.
Yeah.
And just to kind of understand whether... everybody has an opinion, right?
I thought
it was something my parents used to say about opinions.
Yeah, just, I mean, simply thinking, do I know this is true? That's, like, huge.
Yeah.
Do I know, like, this assumption I have about this person who's typed something on the screen, do I know that it's true? Do I know that they're, like, what their intention is? And then when you're like, no, I don't actually. It could be something else. I don't think it is, but it could be. That's usually how we think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I will end up closing it once and I'm like, I'm not going to fight with anybody. Okay, I can close it now.
It's good to have that sort of practice too. I mean, as long as...
I see it as that right now.
Yeah.
It's more like a practice there.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a waste of time.
Sometimes. It can be, yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Let's end with, let's just close our eyes for a few moments. And just feel everything soften and relax. as we say our prayers, offer all the merit as we're saying the prayers, with the understanding of emptiness to reaching our full potential Buddhahood in this life for the sake of all living beings. So have that energy as Jenny leads us in the prayers.
Sashi
Puki Chukshing Me Tok Cham Rirab Lingxin Yen De Gen Padi Sangye Shingdu Mikte Oargi Jokun Amdak Shingla Chuparshu Iram Guru Radna Mandala Kam Nirya Sayami
Gewa
Di Gewa Kun Sunam Yeshe Sok Sok Shing Sunam Yeshe